Shrink Wrap Radio number 746, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry, with Daniel Barron, MD.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Daniel Barron, MD, author of Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry. Dr. Barron completed his medical training and psychiatry residency at Yale University, where he was the chief resident of both Yale's Neuroscience Research Training Program and of the Clinical Neuroscience Research Unit. He holds a PhD in human brain imaging from the University of Texas and is a regular contributor to Scientific American. He is currently a fellow in pain medicine at the University of Washington and lives in Seattle with his wife and son. Reading Our Minds is his first book. He also has a podcast named Science et al. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Daniel Barron, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, thank you for having me here.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. I've been looking forward to speaking with you to talk about your very thought-provoking book, Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry. And, you know, I think, I'm sure you've already thought about this, but I think if you were to ask a person on the street, what are your associations to big data? I'm not sure they'd be positive. I don't know how many people would have a positive. So in a way, it's a little bit of a risk, I think.
Sure.
And I think you probably thought about that. And in some ways, I could see your book as really all about preparing a public to be positively oriented to the idea of big data psychiatry, which initially might sound a bit cold and scary.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the goals of the book was to encourage a conversation, right? That way, both to explain or try to step people through ways in which I think big data might be helpful, and also to start a conversation about how we could go about making it helpful.
Yeah.
And so, like you're suggesting, I think we hear about big data and big tech as being, you know, kind of this nefarious, you know, cloud in the sky thing that's watching us. And I think a large reason why that has happened was no one was really anticipating the role it would play in our lives. And because of that, you know, the legal and ethical protections weren't really in place.
Right.
So we should start talking now about it. That way we can build towards that future.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that, a point that you make in the book that made me realize that, oh, yeah, I'm already comfortable with big data in many ways. I really rely on Siri and the Maps app on my smartphone to get anywhere.
Right.
I don't know how I got anywhere before that.
I'm the same way, yeah.
We used to have to open up a big map in the car. And it would cover the windshield. You couldn't really do it while you were driving when you needed that information. So there are lots of ways that we're using big data and have accepted it without too much pain and complaint. There's also a dark side, and we may talk about that a further along towards the end. But your book starts off with a case, and maybe that's a good place to get us oriented to the topic here. Where you're a psychiatrist, you were working in a psychiatric facility, and you're confronted with a young woman who needs to be diagnosed. And her pseudonym in your book is Irene. Take us from there.
Right. So, and this is a very common occurrence. Every clinician has been in this situation where a patient, a complete stranger, comes to your office and says, there's something wrong. Or in Irene's case, there was nothing wrong, according to her. What should be done? And so diagnosis, I view diagnosis kind of a means to an end. And the real goal of the clinical interactions is to figure out how to help. And so I was sitting in front of Irene and, you know, it just wasn't clear. Like in some cases, it's very obvious. Like I was working in the psychiatric emergency room here and I had a patient who was, you know, very quite manic and psychotic. It's like, I knew in about 3 seconds what that diagnosis and possible treatment would be, right?
Yeah.
But it's the cases that aren't obvious that require the most amount of, you know, useful and very reliable information. And
yeah.
So sitting with her and then speaking with her mother who happened to be there, and it became more clear what, you know, could be done to help Irene. And at the same time, I wondered and I spoke with Irene and her mother about these other tools that might be helpful. You know, not in a diagnostic sort of way, but more in a, these are my limitations as a clinician. And in Irene's case, a lot of her delusions and kind of oddities were sleuthing online, like spending a lot of time online. And, you know, she wasn't going out and around town with her friends anymore. And so I described a series of tools, which I go on to describe in the book, that might have been helpful.
Yes.
And yet, you know, we don't have access to them right now. And because I don't have quantitative tools like that, like I really couldn't be much more specific than our conversation. So it's very much like a confession of my limitations as a person and clinician, and also kind of a hope for what might be done in the future.
Yeah, you go into some detail about, you start off with a mental status exam, which is standard practice in psychiatry and intake situations of going through a set of questions. And I think you said there were, how many questions are in the mental status exam? Is there a finite number?
It really depends on how you do it. I think mine had 11 or something.
Okay.
Yeah,
so based on a relatively small number of questions, and you're also under considerable time pressure if you're in the United States medical system.
Right.
Given, I think these days when I go to see the doctor, I think he's got maybe 20 minutes before he's got to move on to the next person. And so in the book, you're very upfront about the challenge of that task that you've got maybe 10 or 20 minutes with this person and you can converse with her, and you also got some information from her mother, but you can't see into her head,
right?
And you don't know what's going on in her brain, and you say that psychiatry is in fact the most far behind as a medical science, that
right.
that it barely deserves the name medical science. Elaborate on that a bit more for us, if you would.
So, you know, to your point, like it's impossible for a clinician to see inside another person's brain. I mean, we can observe behaviors and we can ask patients what's going on, what they feel, what they've been doing. However, that information doesn't necessarily translate into the function of the organ, right? And so other medical specialties have developed instruments that assist the clinician in better understanding the function of their particular organ of interest, right? So if a patient presented to a cardiologist with chest pain, you know, any good cardiologist would sit down with the patient and discuss the chest pain, when it happened, how it makes them feel, surrounding symptoms, possible comorbidities. But then a good cardiologist would listen, right? They would auscultate the heart, and then they would probably order an EKG, an electrocardiogram. You know, and both of those are instruments that have been designed specifically to assist the clinician in gathering data that wouldn't otherwise be gathered and seeing and sensing things that wouldn't otherwise be sensed.
Yeah, and so because, also they've got imaging techniques because I've been to cardiologists. Right. And so they've got ultrasound tests, you know, that can see how your heart is pumping, how the circulation is in your legs, et cetera.
Right. And so the reason all these tests have been created is the cardiologists and the scientists, you know, who are working with them have all decided that cardiology is really hard. It's really hard to understand what's going on in someone's cardiovascular system. And without tools and instruments, a human cardiologist can't do very well. Right. And so we've designed these instruments to be able to help us gather better data. And so having instruments allows you then to perform statistical analyses, right? And then to approach organ function from a scientific perspective.
Yeah.
You can begin to do studies and do statistics and try to test whether different treatments or even different tests themselves are more effective. And psychiatry has been struggling to, you know, keep pace with the other medical specialties, even though, ironically, I think psychiatry is one of the hardest specialties because
Not only
do you have the complexity of, you know, human personality and consciousness or whatever, you know, whatever the belief system is that anyone brings to you, but you also have to understand a lot about brain function, and being able to parse out different abnormalities in that function is very, very difficult.
And so far, we have not been able to you know, there are a lot of sort of psychological difficulties that the hope has always been, well, it's the brain, it's a medical thing. We'll understand the brain well enough to be able to solve it all at that level. But so far, that's been somewhat elusive, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my background is in fMRI analysis, right? So brain imaging analyses, that's what I worked on in grad school. And, you know, a large part of my research program is still related to MRI analyses. And so I'm very much interested in, you know, understanding behavior well enough that we can bring it to neurophysiology, right? To connect what happens in the brain at the neural level or network level with what happens on the behavioral level. And I think, one of the limitations is the complexity of behavior. And right now we really don't measure behavior in the way we measure the function of other organs. Like, again, just to return to the cardiology example, you know, we could say that someone's pulse is a bounding rapid pulse, or we could measure it as 120, you know, beats per minute, and we could have a specific measure of blood pressure. And I think what psychiatry and the behavioral sciences generally are moving towards is trying to define the equivalent of a blood pressure and heart rate for the function of the brain.
Yeah, and so we still don't really have that.
We don't. And I think, and so the you know, this book was an exercise, kind of a meditation in whether digital instruments could be helpful to that end. And I believe I presented the case that they might be, you know, the big M. Hopefully they would be. The data is already being used to that extent in, you know, big tech companies, like, you know, we've mentioned before. I think what remains to be seen now is if the medical community or the scientific community can organize themselves well enough to, you know, be able to see if this data is useful for patients, the same people who are creating the data.
Yeah. I love the example that you give of motoric activity, a person's activity, that could be useful information, say, in studying depression, or diagnostically, and the person that the case of Irene that you talked about was that in fact her mother reported that she wasn't going out as much as she used to. She used to hang out to friends. Now she's spending a lot of time at home. And you sort of said that many tools already exist out there, and not created by medical specialists, but by commercial companies. So, you know, companies like Apple Computer and Google Facebook and, you know, those big names that we know, and that data can be repurposed, possibly, right, depending upon what could be worked out in terms of relationships with them and working out all the ethical challenges and so on. So you gave the example of, you know, I've got an Apple Watch and there are other devices.
Too, right here.
Yeah, mine's laying over here beside me, not doing me any good over there. Fitbit and other devices like that can measure the number of steps, the number of distance gone, with geolocation, even some sense of where they went. And that could be a useful way to have concrete evidence rather than having to rely on a mother that said, well, it doesn't go out as much as she used to.
Right. And so the theme that this is a part of in the book is we don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel in trying to decide which types of data might be helpful. Like activity, psychomotor activity, is a part of every clinician's assessment. Right. We ask people how much they've been sleeping, how active they are, you know, what their daily pattern is like. And so all the digital technology would be doing is a way to more precisely and more reliably get a measurement for that. And so, you know, Irene was very fortunate in that her mother was very observant and cared very much about her. And but, you know, what if people who, you know, even if they do have a mother, they don't live with their mother, you know,
yeah,
people who, you know, are by themselves, you know, how could we gather data that we could use to then help them?
So. Yeah. Now, of course, one of the concerns that listeners and viewers might be likely to have is, well, you know, what about the ethics of this? Who gets to make these decisions? Where is the patient in there in terms of giving permission? Because one thing that you talk about that's really important in all of this is the ability to establish a baseline.
Right.
That whatever behavior you're measuring, you want to have a baseline to know as well, is this the regular thing? Is this what we could call normal? Or has there been a big change? The baseline, both in the individual person, but also maybe in relation to a larger population, how much activity right. most people have or the average person has.
Right.
So an interesting thing that you propose is a navigator. Was it a digital navigator?
Yeah. The digital navigator.
Yeah.
So this is a position which wasn't my creation. This is Dr. Mahmood DeChowdhury. She's down in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory. And I had a wonderful conversation with her. And she's a very thoughtful scientist who has been working in the space of social media. So using social media to be able to predict useful clinical outcomes. Like she started in postpartum depression, right? She recognized that many of her friends who, you know, pregnant, they always announced that they were pregnant on social media, you know, like the ultrasound picture or whatever they would have put up. And then she was curious. She was like, okay, does the way someone expresses themselves online before and after the birth of their child, could that data be predictive of an outcome like postpartum depression? And so in order to gather all of this data, she and her research group piloted a position called a digital navigator. And so this digital navigator is almost like a social worker who is able to kind of describe what's going on in the system of digital space. And so they'll sit down with a patient or a research participant, go over the type of data that, you know, is being proposed, you know, which type of data they want to collect. And then they can discuss how long they want it collected for, both in the future and in the past. Like, for example, do you want to share a month, 2 months, a year, you know, all the way to the back of the beginning of time for your Facebook account, like how much of that data and how far in the future you want to go? Like, do you consent for 2 months, 10 months, however? And then also the digital navigator would, you know, in the future be able to, you know, step the patient through the consent process in terms of who has access to that data,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can envision a situation where a patient might come into a psychiatrist's clinic and the psychiatrist might have a digital navigator that then discusses with the patient whether the cardiology team or the gastroenterology team or, you know, whomever would also have access to the data. And so the goal of all of this, and I feel that this is essential if this sort of data is going to become useful, the goal would be to establish a very clear understanding of what's being gathered, who has access to it, and for how long, so as to be able to have a good therapeutic relationship with the patient. Because, you know, like I'd mentioned with the cardiologist, yeah, cardiologists have a lot of tools and gizmos. But at the end of the day, whether the patient takes their statin or their antihypertensive, there's a large large part of that relationship depends on a relationship, right? Being able to have an alliance with the patient, being able to communicate with them, and you know, have shared goals. And so, unfortunately, this isn't really a conversation that's happening in the digital world right now,
right,
which is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring attention to it.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to make sure people understand that the digital navigator is a job. It's a person.
Yeah.
It's going to be a new career out there. And I think things like that sort of already exist. I think there are probably a variety of things. Like if you're going for certain kinds of dentistry, complex dentistry solutions, the dentist may not be who's going to do the work, may not be the first point of contact. They may put you down with an employee who's kind of specialized in describing the process, what it's going to be like, you know, to get all of your teeth replaced by implants, something
sure.
like that. And yeah, somebody who can kind of hold your hand a bit.
And so I actually just rotated through a palliative care team at the hospital, right? And so the palliative care team has, you know, there's a chaplain, there are social workers for the social workers. And so even though the clinician has expertise in understanding medical conditions and treating those medical conditions, you know, the palliative care team appreciates that the conversation itself is very complex, that the system within which the patient exists, the hospital system, outside of the hospital even, that's a very complex system. And so there are people with specialized training that help patients navigate that complex system. And so I think in the
same way— I'm missing a word. The something of care?
Palliative care?
Palliative care. I've got some hearing issues here.
Oh,
palliative care.
Okay. Yeah, the palliative care team.
Palliative care team. Okay, now I got it. Good.
Yeah, and so these are this is a team of clinicians and chaplains and social workers at the hospital that mm-hmm. you know help support families who are often faced with you know a terminal illness or you know very complex medical conditions, and so they have appreciated that the system is complex enough that there are yes. team members with specialized training that can help patients navigate a system.
Yeah.
And so I view the digital navigator as being, you know, comparable to something like that.
Yeah. No, you keep going.
I was just going to say, digital data is complex.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's complex, and having someone with specialized training that can help patients understand and then, you know, have, you know, autonomy and be able to decide what happens to their data, I think is going to be part of our future here.
I think what you saw play across my face was that I was thinking about new careers that, you know, there's the fear that automation of everything is going to get rid of all the jobs and also the oft given advice to young people, well, there are going to be careers out there that maybe don't even exist now, but, you know, so that's kind of lighting up that bulb in my brain, you know, that, this is an example of, you know, careers that haven't previously existed, but we still need people. There are things that people can do with other people that hopefully can't be replaced.
Yeah, no one was genuinely afraid that the electrocardiogram was going to put cardiologists out of business.
Uh-huh.
But instead, what it did was allow cardiologists to be more effective. And then also, now there are EKG technicians, right?
Yeah.
There are people who have special expertise in, you know, performing electrocardiograms or gathering that data. So
now, this is bringing to mind, and I can't remember the total details of it, but there was a whole flap about data being used not in a transparent way with Facebook. Remind me, what that study, what were they trying to accomplish? And then it kind of blew up in their face in a certain way.
Oh, not in my book, but just kind of in
Yeah.
So if I'm thinking of the same thing you are, unfortunately, I think there's been more than one instance of this. But the study I have in mind is Facebook had, based on the emotional content of posts, they wanted to see whether they could essentially manipulate someone's emotional state.
That's it.
So, like, if we show this person more negative posts, are they more likely to post something negative in return? So they did, evidently, their study did work, which is one of the reasons it was so troubling.
Yes.
And they don't do that anymore.
Right. So we may come back to that. Where was I just going to go? It's just eluded me. Suicide. You mentioned a study of now this is sounds like it could be an example of something similar, except I guess they're not doing any manipulation of people. But you described a very interesting study of somebody's looking at the search terms history, that people use. So tell us a bit about that, and particularly the study in relation to suicide.
Yeah, so the main take home from the study was an analysis of someone's search history. So their Google search history was more predictive of a clinical outcome like suicide than their recent clinician's note. Right. So in essentially if I had seen a patient and I had asked them, I had performed a suicide assessment, I might not have been able to detect whether this patient was suicidal. However, if I had had access to this patient's Google search history, that data might have led me to conclude this person was at risk. And that's kind of the take home from it. And, you know, thinking through that, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense, actually. I mean, I think patients are more honest with Google than they are with their doctors. There's also a study about pregnant women who are more likely to Google whether they can eat soft cheese or drink alcohol. You know, they're more likely to ask these things of the internet than they are of their own physician.
Yeah, fascinating.
I think that was a very interesting study as well.
And I seem to recall, though, that there were a huge – that how to commit suicide was one of the most frequent queries.
Yeah, because, you know, you're not going to ask your doctor how to do that. You're going to look at Google, right?
Yeah. So, you know, that sounds like there's some important information there. I guess there's a lot of information that is potentially important and could be useful to government and other kinds of good government. humane, scientifically oriented government.
And to your point, though, I mean, I think the government already has access to this information. I mean, that was something that you know, was very untroubling in the last few years, was how much the governments actually do follow us and use these data.
Yeah.
And so right now, you know, there's this term of marketing surveillance, which is what big tech does, like Google, Amazon. You know, they monitor our behavior and try to, you know, understand our behavior well enough to market us products.
Right.
And then there's the government, which, you know, produces security surveillance, which is intended, you know, ostensibly to keep us safe, you know, by being able to detect, you know, whether there's a, you know, a terrorist attack or, you know, what have you. And so the only people who don't have access to this data in a behavioral way are the patients and their clinicians. And so being able to find some way which everyone is comfortable with, which makes sense and could be useful, is kind of where I hope we're heading.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about some of the different technologies that can be used. I'm still thinking about the surveillance.
Yeah.
Because it very much depends upon what country you're living in,
right.
how it's going to be used. And there's some scary stuff happening around that. But you kind of illuminate some of the technologies that already exist where a cooperative relationship could perhaps be developed between the technology companies like Apple or Facebook to get certain kinds of data for certain purposes. And so one of the categories that you look at is social media, and we've been talking about that a bit. Google does something called nowcasting, or I don't know if that's a word you invented. I've never heard of nowcasting before.
I don't know if Google came up with it. It's a word that I learned while I was researching, but there's nowcasting and future scoping, all these kind of cool words that are coming out.
Yeah. So what is nowcasting and how might that be useful?
So nowcasting is the ability to look at what someone is posting or searching for to try to understand what's going on now in their life.
Uh-huh.
Right. So instead of forecasting, when you're trying to predict the future, you know, nowcasting would be, can we create a profile to see what's going on in this person's life right now? And some of the tools that are being used to that end are, you know, online searches and Google histories and social media data.
Yeah, so I guess an example of new nowcasting might be, I've just done a search on athletic shoes, and the next thing I know, an ad is being pushed toward me.
That's the marketing surveillance for you,
yeah,
right?
For some athletic shoes.
My toddler loves trucks, and so I get a lot of ads for, you know, trucks, all sorts.
Oh, trucks,
like pickup trucks. Yeah, you know, he watches all these animated car and truck videos, and I get the strangest advertisements. I think Google doesn't know what to make of my YouTube feed.
Yeah, right.
It's like, who is this guy?
Yeah, let's see. Here's a neuroscientist who's interested in all these strange trucks, earth movers, and things like that. Yeah. You make a distinction between there's the nowcasting kind of thing and stuff. By the way, one of my other hats is as a market researcher. So I've conducted lots of focus groups with people over the years. And I always looked at that as benign. It feels like my peers don't really they never have these conversations that I think need to be had. One thing is they're quick to scoop up any new tools from neuroscience or any place and make claims around those, or anything from psychology, you know, like projective testing and so on. And I don't know where I was going to go with that, but except that it's happening there. Oh, I always thought that it was democratic, you know, we tell people what we're going to be talking about in the group and so on. And the company's trying to understand them so that they can give them what they want.
Right.
So there is that bright face of it that I feel good about. You talk about there's passive data is another form of data that's out there. And you talk about things like accelerometers and geolocation and call logs.
Right.
And we've already hinted at physical activity is a thing that could be monitored. You gave an example in the book that you write for example, in 2015, a group of scientists led by Dr. Cheryl Corcoran, I think maybe this was the one you mentioned, at Columbia University reported subtle speech patterns, far too subtle for a clinician to detect, as evident in schizophrenia, even prior to the first psychosis onset. Well, this must be pretty cutting edge. I mean, I haven't heard that this is, in fact, an accepted way of detecting schizophrenia yet.
So all of the tools that I describe in the book are very much in the research phase. Uh-huh. And so I don't, you know, I'm not suggesting any of these tools are ready for, you know, prime time in the clinic.
Yeah.
They're all promising research tools, which is one of the reasons I was excited to write about them and you know, yeah. meet with the scientists doing the studies. And so Cheryl's study was actually, there was an original study and then a validation study. So she's had a good reproducible set. And what she did was just record unstructured speech, right? She would ask patients about their symptoms, about their experience of being chronically high risk was the category, right? So these were individuals who were identified as being predisposed to a psychotic episode or to schizophrenia, however, had never had a psychotic episode or had not yet been diagnosed. And so she asked them to just talk about their experience and using these, you know, processing tools for language, she transcribed their speech. So she had it all written down and then was able to detect subtle changes like the way people would refer to themselves. Mm. Right. So they used different types of determiners, even, which is a specific part of a sentence. And so like these very subtle things that, you know, I'm not capable of detecting anyway during a conversation. The algorithms, these machine learning methods were able to show that they were predictive of a later psychotic break, which would suggest that the way people's brain processes information and the sort of behavioral outputs that they have are predictive of a clinically useful outcome.
Okay. So, you talk about you talk about machine learning.
I'm going to prop up this door that way it stops slamming.
Okay.
I'm going to press. I'll be right back.
Okay.
There we go. Hopefully that'll. I just kept hearing it like, and it shakes the walls.
I'm glad you did that. I thought, oh, I wonder if somebody else is in the room with you there, moving furniture or something.
there's a main thoroughfare.
They're moving you out, even as we're talking.
that's the way it goes. Sorry about that.
Yeah. We're touching on machine learning, which gets into artificial intelligence. And again, that's one of those things that looks like it's got a dark face, it's got a bright face in terms of its potential. And so there are a lot of ways in which artificial intelligence is already in the developmental stages, I think, of helping diagnosticians analyze things like retinal studies is one thing that I'm aware of where they've got the artificial intelligence to the place where it can, if presented with pictures of retinas, that it can diagnose certain conditions at about the same level as a very skilled retinologist, you know, within some degree of confidence, but can it process a lot more of them than a human being can?
Right. And also the algorithm, the artificial intelligence algorithm doesn't get tired. It doesn't forget to have its coffee and, you know, it doesn't have a lunch break. And so, you know, it doesn't get cut off on the way to work and is grumpy all morning.
Yeah.
Of course, things that never happen to me. But I think the added value of algorithms like that is to be able to detect more consistently a signal that, you know, humans believe is relevant, right?
Yeah.
So I believe the study you're referring to is a diabetic retinopathy or even a retinal detachment. And so there's another study on skin cancer, right? And so you
On what?
Skin cancer.
Skin cancer, yes.
Skin cancer, right? So you can take a picture with your phone and send it to this algorithm and it'll detect what type of skin cancer. Now, this is still in the research phase, but there is an article in Nature, the journal Nature about it, three or four years ago. And I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm personally excited by the stuff that Apple Computer is doing with the Apple Watch. They seem to be leading the charge in some ways of the possibilities of exploring how measurements taken from a person's risk might correlate with a variety of medical conditions, you know, and I think they're moving towards being able to give, for diabetics, not having to puncture themselves to draw blood, but getting some kind of a reading. I think that's one of the big goals, and that'll be just so welcome and useful.
It'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be really awesome. And I'm excited to see the progress in that field. I mean, I think it'd be very spectacular.
Yeah.
So I have a patient that showed up, and I was just stalking. I would love to answer more questions or pick up at a later time, but I think I might have to go here in just a minute to go and see my next patient this afternoon.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we'll have. Do we have? Can you give me a? Can we have 5 minutes, or you need to go?
Sure. Now? Yeah, let's have another five. Yeah, that'd be great. I'm enjoying this conversation very much. I had a patient add on an unexpected clinical complication that I'm usually free until 1 o'clock. And today they scheduled them at 12:30 for some reason. And so I apologize for that, but it wasn't really in my control having this add-on patient.
Well, I loved your discussion of the brain as an inference machine, where you talk about different models of the brain and we've likened the brain to clocks and to computers and various kinds of metaphors. And I thought the inference machine discussion was very useful and a place to intervene as a way to look at what's going on with possible psychoses of various sorts, is if people are drawing inferences to look at the process and the inferences that they're drawing and whether or not those make sense. I was going to ask you about the pandemic, and actually before I got through your book, I thought I would ask you about the pandemic, and then I saw that you addressed it directly in one of the last chapters. So what would you say the impact of the pandemic is on the uptake of the ideas, the potential uptake of the ideas that you're promoting?
So I think the pandemic, you know, for all the terrible things that have happened during this time, I feel like people have really been more exposed to these sorts of digital measurements. And for example, people on their own volition uploaded temperature data to online servers. That way the CDC could try to track the outbreak of COVID. People are aware that Google searches for symptoms of COVID. Specifically, there were a few articles in the news about, I can't smell. people asking Google, why can't I smell? That sort of information was useful to nowcast the outbreak of, COVID. And so I think people are more familiar with it now. That could also be in a bad way, right? So also during the pandemic, a lot of news has come out about, certain tools that big tech has been using to monitor us. And so I think right now is an ideal time for people to think carefully about what value these tools might have and whether we feel comfortable incorporating them into our clinical lives.
Did you see the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma?
Yes. About Facebook.
Yeah. I don't think it was just Facebook, but several of the big companies. And the thing that alarms me is that trained neuroscientists have been assisting these companies in making their sites, quote, sticky or addictive.
Oh, right.
So these are your peers. How do you feel about people who have the kind of training that you have, who are, doing that kind of work?
I don't know anyone who does that. I suspect, much like, your history with marketing, you thought that you were, promoting something useful and good for society. Yeah. And, I'm willing to give, whatever neuroscientists are working with, I don't know, Amazon or whomever, kind of the benefit of the doubt. I think it's something that needs to be talked about more.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I that's not really my domain of expertise.
You know much more about marketing.
Yeah. I suspect, you know, I don't mean to turn the question around, but I mean, do you think that those things are useful? You know, with your experience in marketing, like, do you think that there's, you know, neuroscientific validity to something like that? Like, I don't know.
Oh, well, it's been, you know, we understand a lot about addiction and how to make things kind of addictive. And I think it's a very perverse use of that knowledge. So, you know, I'm very clear about that. You're doing some interesting, you're going into a new job, heading up a pain clinic. And I'm hoped that we get to have an interview down the road after you've been in that for a while and to interview you again about that. But you've got important work to do now. So I will let you go. And I want to thank you so much for being my guest, Dr. Daniel Barron. I highly recommend the book.
Thanks
for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I was very pleased to have this opportunity to chat with Dr. Daniel Barron about his provocative book, Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry. I say the book is provocative because the term big data psychiatry will strike many of us as cold and frightening. Don't people suffering from mental illness need human warmth, empathy, and understanding to promote their healing? As initially off-putting as the title may be, what the book proposes is not necessarily inimical to those human qualities we associate with psychotherapy. As a matter of fact, the book is not so much about treatment as it is about diagnosis. Figuring out what's going on with the patient that is causing their suffering so that an effective treatment can be recommended. I think Dr. Barron's book is doing a real service by alerting both public and professionals not so much to what is coming, but what is already in our midst. He seeks to stimulate a conversation so that these technological tools and opportunities have wise and ethical oversight. Technology is moving at such a rapid pace that we often seem to be backpedaling with the realization that the necessary guidelines, ethics, and legal boundaries are not in place. Over and over again, it seems that we are living in a world burdened by unintended consequences. One example that comes to mind is the genetic modification tool CRISPR. My impression is that there was an informal understanding among scientists that the tool should not be used to modify the human germline. Yet a rogue scientist in China is reported to have done just that. According to an online journal article with the title, No Time to Waste, The Ethical Challenges Created by CRISPR, and I quote from the article, in addition to the discussion about human germline editing, CRISPR raises or revives many other ethical issues, not all of which concern only humans, but also other species and the environment. Close quote. Dr. Barron suggests that commercial services like Google, Facebook, and Twitter, among others, are already gathering a wealth of information that is potentially useful for psychiatry. Using natural language processing and artificial intelligence tools, there's a ton of information already gathered and used extensively for marketing to us. Dr. Barron points out that these techniques and data could be repurposed to answer mental health questions. For example, he writes, and I quote, psychiatry is in the enviable position of having access to technologies to rigorously measure what we all agree is clinically relevant data. I routinely ask my patients how much they're sleeping, how active they are, what they're thinking about, and I've described a series of tools that have been specifically designed to measure these very things. They're already being used with astonishing levels of success by tech companies to measure, trace, and act on our habits and patterns. Notwithstanding the widespread implementation of digital measurements in the tech world, and notwithstanding the impressive studies showing how digital measures could augment healthcare, the routine application of these tools has not yet been adopted in psychiatry to measure, trace, and improve our mental health. It's tempting to view this disconnect as simply a Luddite's refusal to embrace technology. Perhaps, even as clinicians stubbornly refuse to admit that what we're doing might be improved. Close quote. I appreciate the roadmap Dr. Barron has provided us in this book. He underscores the opportunities and, at the same time, is not unaware of pitfalls that need to be avoided. I must hasten to add that my own experience of Dr. Barron in this interview is that he is a warm, caring psychiatrist who is passionate to improve the practice of psychiatry and the treatment of the mentally ill. His book is very readable, and I recommend it to all. Once again, the title is Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry by Daniel Barron, M.D.
Hello, Dr. Dave. It's Claire Edwards from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, Australia here. I work as a facilitator and coach specializing in neuroleadership and positive psychology. Dr. Dave and your Shrink Wrap Radio form an integral part of my continued professional development. Being based in Australia, it's so convenient for me just to download the podcast and listen at a time convenient to me. I also really enjoy the breadth of experts and the wide range of opinions, which helps me form my own conclusions. Dr. Dave, thanks again for providing such a valuable, insightful, and value-added service.
Thank you, Claire Edwards in Queensland, Australia, for your wonderful evaluation of Shrink Wrap Radio as a useful and value-added service. If those of you listening agree with Claire's evaluation and are able to do so, I hope you will make either a one-time or continuing contribution by going to shrinkwrapradio.com and clicking on donations. Again, I want to thank all of our regular donors out there. Your names are on the honor roll on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. This morning, I've been going through updating donors from 2020 to 2021. Once again, and not only do I get to review the names of you faithful supporters of this work, but also to experience fresh gratitude for your continuing support in this new year. A big thank you to all of you folks. Thanks to today's guest, psychiatrist and neuroscientist Daniel Barron, for discussing his book on big data psychiatry. Next week's guest will be dream worker and president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and will be discussing her own work as well as the upcoming IASD virtual conference. So all you dreamers should definitely tune in. So until then, please remember to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.